John Bolton, who served as Donald Trump's third national security advisor over 17 months, said he had never heard of the standing order that Mr. Trump's office claimed to have in place. It is, he said, almost certainly a lie. I was never briefed on any such order, procedure, policy when I came in, John Bolton said, adding that he had never been told of it while he was working there, and had never heard of such a thing after. If he were to say something like that, you would have to memorialize that so that people would know it existed, he said. What's more, he pointed out, secure facilities for viewing sensitive material were constructed at Donald Trump's clubs in Florida and New Jersey, when he often spent weekends as president, meaning that the documents wouldn't need to be declassified. And if they were declassified, John Bolton said, they would be considered subject to public record requests. He continued, when somebody begins to concoct lies like this, it shows a real level of desperation. The claim that the documents held in the Florida residence were declassified also undercut an assertion one of Mr. Trump's lawyers made back in June. In a written declaration, the lawyer's team said all material marked as classified and stored at Mar-a-Lago had been returned to the government. This week, Donald Trump again accused the Justice Department of acting as a tool for his political opponents, a familiar tactic for a former president who had tried repeatedly to politicize the department during his 4 years in office. Describing the FBI as corrupt, Donald Trump suggested that its agents had planted incriminating material at Mar-a-Lago during the search and demanded they return documents that he said were protected by executive privilege. Such accusations of political motivation prompted Attorney General Merrick Garland to defend the FBI's agents during brief remarks earlier this week. Donald Trump's unverified accusations also came as the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security last week issued an intelligence bulletin that warned of an increase in threats against federal law enforcement after a search of Mar-a-Lago, including general calls for a civil war or armed rebellion.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I'm your host, Zainab Askari. Well, we have heard about the events of Karbala and women who had played important role in it. But there's a question that were there women before the moment of Karbala? Were there women during the Karbala? We know that. But were there women post-Karbala and what was their role? We got to talk about all that in our studio with Siddiqa. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. And thank you for having me today. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Sadiqa. Thank you so much for accepting the invitation. A very warm welcome.
Thank you.
Well, dear listeners, Sadiqa is a student of Islamic jurisprudence in the House of Islam of Qom, and she's a researcher about the women issues. Well, Sadiqa, since you study a lot, do extensive research on the issues of women today, since we are going in the holy month of Muharram and Safar, so I would want to know from you. We know that Karbala was a moment in itself, or sometimes it's even said in many quotes that Hussein was not a particular person. It's the name of a moment. So in this moment of Karbala, who supported Imam Hussein alayhi salam? I mean to say, in terms of women, we know he had a lot of companions. We know he had males, females supporting him. But I would want to know from you, before we get into the discussion, who were the women supporting Imam Hussein al-Islam prior to Karbala?
Yes, so when we are looking at the whole movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we see that we had women who supported him when he was on his way to Karbala. So there's a group of women who supported the movement before the actual event, that actual battle happened.
Yeah.
And then you have a group of women who supported him in Karbala.
Yeah.
Who continued his message post-Karbala. Yeah. And after Karbala had finished, you had a group of women who rose to continue the movement and fight against Yazid in order to bring down that dynasty, because this whole movement of Imam Hussein had woken up those dead spirits.
Yeah.
That had died because of years and years of Islamic ignorance. People had left the religion.
Yeah.
Religion was on the tongues, like Imam Hussein alayhi salam was very rightly said. Religion is on the tongue of the people. When things get hard, they run away. Yeah. And this is what had happened. It had come on the tongues only.
Yeah.
So yes, there were a group of women who supported Imam Hussein alayhi salam prior to that actual battle.
Okay.
And they were supportive in the whole movement.
Mm-hmm.
I have a list of three women. There would be more, but I've only narrowed it down to three. The first of them is the one who supported his ambassador. What happened was, the people of Kufa invited Imam Hussein alayhi salam to come and guide them, right? So they wrote, we have historical narrations that say 18,000 letters came to Imam Hussein, and some of them were signed with multiple signatures. So you can, between 18 to 21,000, we know that there are these amount of letters who come, okay, which come to Imam Hussein to guide the people of Kufa. And some of them wrote that if you do not guide us, we are going to go and complain to your grandfather on the day of judgment.
Yeah.
So Imam Hussein sets off. Now Imam Hussein is being taken out of Medina. His life is in danger in Medina.
Yeah.
He heads towards Makkah, then towards Kufa.
Yeah.
Before going towards Kufa, he sends his ambassador, Muslim ibn Aqil, who was also his cousin.
Yeah.
Muslim ibn Aqil goes to Kufa. He's welcomed by a lot of people. Then all of them leave him. Interestingly, Ibn Ziyad enters Kufa with the fear of Ibn Ziyad. These same people who invite Imam Hussein leave his ambassador and run away.
All right. So Muslim ibn Aqil, have a dual character people over here.
Very dual character. Very hypocritical.
Oh.
They leave him. They leave Muslim ibn Aqil. He's alone. He's moving between the streets. He doesn't have any family. His companions are imprisoned. Han ibn Urwa was imprisoned and then later killed.
Okay.
Who was one of the supporters of Musab ibn Aqil in that time. There was a lady by the name of Tawa.
Okay.
She sees Muslim at her doorstep and she asks him, who are you? And he's like, can you give me some water? So she gives him some water and then he sits over there. He doesn't have any other place to go. She tells him, go home. He's like, I don't have a place to go. She's like, I think you're Muslim. He's like, yes. Tawa was one of the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt. She gives him security in her house.
Okay.
Unfortunately, her son is the one who leaks Muslim ibn Aqil's position in her house, and Ibn Ziyad's army comes to kill him.
All right.
But the fact that she supported Imam Hussein by giving security to one of his ambassadors means indirectly she supported his movement.
Exactly.
That's one. Then we have Daylam. Daylam played a very important role. She is the model of how a wife should be.
Okay.
Daylam was the wife of Zuhair ibn Qain. Zuhair ibn Qain was traveling with his wife. Imam Hussein has left Makkah, he's going towards Kufa. All right. On the way, the two caravans meet each other. Zuhair ibn Qain is trying to run away from Imam Hussein. Zuhair ibn Qain was traveling separately with Daylam, his wife. Imam Hussein is traveling separately. He's going towards Kufa. On the way, the paths meet. Imam Hussein calls Zuhair. He wants to invite Zuhair to his movement.
Mm-hmm.
But Zuhair doesn't want to go.
All right.
So Imam Hussein sends his messenger.
Is he scared?
He's not scared. He just doesn't want to interfere in this matter.
All right. So now, what was the role of this lady? I'll ask you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. This is Muslim Lady. We're talking about the role of women in Karbala prior to the event of Karbala itself. So yes, Siddiqa, you were saying the role of second lady.
Daylam, yes. So Imam Hussein sends a messenger to Zuhair.
Okay.
Zuhair doesn't want to go. Daylam tells him, she looks at him and she says, the son of the Prophet is calling and you are still thinking about it? Get up and go. So he listens to his wife. He goes to meet Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein invites him to his movement, tells him a few things. Zuhair ibn Qain agrees. He's like, yes, I believe in your movement now. He goes to his wife. And he tells her, look, I'm going to join Imam Hussein.
All right.
You don't feel any trouble after this. So Daylam played a very important role by
convincing
her husband to join the movement of Imam Hussein. She was not present in Karbala, but what she did was that after the event of Karbala had happened, and she was following this event very closely.
So here we can say that women who themselves cannot directly participate in the jihad, but at the same time can play a very, very,
very
important role. Convincing their husbands, convincing their sons, convincing, providing any kind of support like
yes.
we saw before.
Yes. And so Daylam later sends her servant to Karbala to cover the body of Zuhair.
Yeah.
And the servant goes and sees the body of Imam Hussein lying over there. So he thinks to himself, he says, how can I shroud the body of my master when the son of the Prophet is unshrouded?
Mm-hmm.
So he goes and shrouds the body of Imam Hussein first. So this is the role of Daylam.
Then
we have a third woman, Maria. Maria, who's the daughter of Munqadha Abdiyeh. She was based in Kufa, I believe. It was Kufa or Basra.
Okay.
But her house was the place where she used to invite the women.
Yeah.
And they used to have discussions on the political situation of the time.
Yeah.
They used to discuss the hadith. And through this, she used to encourage people to go and fight for the movement of Imam Hussein. And according to history, two men ended up going to Kufa to support Imam Hussein. She was in Basra. Her house became a source of discussion on how to help the movement of Imam Hussein. And later we know that two men mm-hmm. who used to pass through this house, who used to participate in these discussions or were part of these discussions, later went to Kufa to help the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Okay.
So these are the three women we can highlight who played an important role prior to the event itself. Karbala itself is a movement. You know, Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura says, I'm the one who has been killed because of Saqifah.
Okay.
Right? Karbala is something that it is the conclusion of an event that happened many years ago.
Yeah.
But it's a complete movement that teaches us to rise up against falsehood wherever you are. It doesn't matter what gender or race you are.
All right.
And therefore, these three women can be highlighted as having played a role prior to that battle itself.
Exactly. We'll talk more on that after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. Talking about the role of women prior to Karbala, you gave us examples of three women who provided extensive support to Imam Hussein al-Islam prior to his journey. So is there any more women you would like to add?
Actually, yes. It just came to mind right now.
Yeah.
There was a woman by the name Umm Wahab.
Okay.
Now, she has a role to play even in the battle itself. But prior to the battle itself, she lived with her husband in Kufa.
Yeah.
Her husband goes out and he sees an army being prepared
Yeah.
to go to fight Imam Hussein. He goes back to his wife and he says, I want to go and fight in the army of Imam Hussein.
Yeah.
Because I believe fighting against these group who want to kill the son of the Prophet is better than fighting the kafir, fighting the polytheists.
Okay.
So he says, I want to go. His wife encourages him. She's like, excellent, you've done the best thing you can do. Mm. Take me with you. I want to come with you.
Okay.
So she accompanies her husband. And according to some of the books, some of the historical traditions that we have, they reach on the 8th of Muharram. They live within the shadows of the nights.
Yeah.
Because the doors of Kufa were closed off for the people. People were not allowed to go to Imam Hussein at this time. So they somehow get out and they reach Karbala, according to some historical traditions, on the 8th of Muharram. Umme Wahab had a very important role. Now, we have different traditions of who she was. Two traditions I've read, but I'll only narrate one of what she did. On the day of Ashura itself, now she has a role prior to the battle itself and a role in the battle itself.
Okay.
In the battle, she takes a stick, runs out of the tent to fight Yazid's army.
All right, and so there's an army who are with swords and who are with arrows, and there's a woman coming out of the tents with stick.
With a weapon. From what I've read, it's a stick.
Okay.
She kills two people over there.
Wow.
Imam Hussein prays for her. He says, but go back. Jihad is not wajib on women right now.
Yeah.
So he sends her back. But then her husband goes to the battle. Some traditions state that even her husband's mother was present.
Okay.
So he goes to the battle. Umme Wahab's husband goes to the battle. He fights. According to some traditions, he goes back to his mother. He tells her, are you pleased with me? She's like, I will never be pleased with you until you die in the path of Hussein.
Okay.
So he goes back to the battle. He dies. Now his wife, Umme Wahab, goes to the battle, sits at his head, wipes the blood off his head, and says, intercede with me when you meet the Prophet.
All right.
And Shimmer sees her over there. He sends his servant, Rustam, to go kill her. And she dies. She's the first female martyr.
All right.
From the battle itself. But she played a role before the battle itself.
And in the battle itself.
And she's killed in the battle as well.
All right. And she gets that status of martyrdom.
Exactly.
All right. So because she played a role prior to the moment of Karbala and in the Karbala itself. Well, you know, all this reminds me of some lines from Ziyarat Ashura, which says, may Allah's curse be upon the group who fought against Hussein and those who followed them and supported them and assisted them in killing him. But at the same time, if we reverse the line, may Allah's blessings be upon those who supported Hussein before Karbala, in Karbala, and post-Karbala. And may Allah's blessings be upon these women, like as we say, فَشَوْعَاتْ وَبَوْعَاتْ وَتَوْبَعَاتْ, who provided all the grounds before, in the journey or post-journey. Thank you so much, Sadiqa, for being with us. Inshallah, we'll continue the discussion in next session with you. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. In case you have any questions, any suggestions for us, please write to us on englishradio@irib.ir. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends. And here is another thought-provoking maxim from the immortal martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, the younger grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He who tries to achieve something by being disobedient to Allah will not achieve what he expects and will fall into what he fears.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Forestry authorities in southwestern China have opened a new canteen for wild Asian elephants in a bid to stop them wandering into villages. The canteen in Yunnan province provides the animals with attractive and nutritious meals while exploring man-animal harmonious coexistence. During these years, the province has explored multiple ways to reduce the encounters between humans and elephants and try to keep the animals away from farmers' crops. There are now approximately 1,400 hectares of dining halls for elephants, with many expanding from 100 to 240, such as corn, rice and sugarcane. They are planted on a large scale and within easy reach of the elephants. The location of such canteens is extremely selective, usually away from villages and major roads, and the chefs are locals.
stunning scenes in Spain as the last supermoon of the year illuminates the night sky amid fireworks and fairs marking the start of festivities for a public holiday. In Malaga, fireworks left the sky a mix of colours against the bright moon. There was also a spectacle of drones that lightened the sturgeon moon. Locals in the Canary Islands also celebrated the three-day holiday by lighting up a Ferris wheel as the full moon beamed beautifully in the sky. If the moon is within 10% of its closest distance to Earth at the moment of full moon, it is called a supermoon. The supermoon has various hues and appears bigger and brighter than when the moon is at its farthest point from Earth. Have you ever heard of fighting nature with nature? Well, that's what the San Francisco Metro system in the U.S. did to stop pigeons from overrunning the place. The station has hired a hawk as the new guard to patrol the area. Pac-Man is a 5-year-old Harris's hawk who has taken up the perch at the station. In terms of experience, he is pretty new as he finished training only 9 months ago. The station recently renovated its building, installing netting and spikes to prevent pigeons from nesting. But these birds still seem to find their way to hang around. So with the Falconer Force, Ricky Ortiz and his hawk were hired this summer to keep the pigeons at bay.
So a typical day is we get here and we make our round. We start off down in the bottom inside the facility, making sure there's no pigeons hanging out in there. And then we work our way up here to the platforms and just check the ledges and the roof and make sure that they're not trying to sneak in on us and keep them out. And he does a pretty good job of that.
The team patrols 3 days a week and Pac-Man is allowed to swoop in and scare any pigeons sitting around. The Falconer says less than half of the pigeons left after the first week of Pac-Man flying and establishing the territory. Commuters and station managers say they also noticed the difference. The Falconer says he usually keeps his feathery friend happy on the job by giving him snacks throughout the day. This also encourages the hawk not to feast on the pigeons and local rodents.
Technology helps transform the global food production system and mitigates its impact on the environment. China's autonomous region of Tibet is turning barren land into fertile one using greenhouse technology. Once removed, Beinan County is now the largest off-season vegetable supplier in Tibet. The region has taken advantage of its highland conditions to develop a state-of-the-art agricultural structure. Beinong has now more than 2,200 modern vegetable greenhouses and nearly 12,000 hectares of planting area, some built at unimaginable altitude. But one cannot deny the role of railways and highway transport for making this county a hub for organic vegetables. The income of locals has also been significantly improved, and they are now living a happy and prosperous life. If you're a private collector of wild animals, there is good news for you. A Pakistani zoo is auctioning off a dozen lions due to a lack of money to feed them and a space to house them. Lahore Safari Zoo currently has so many big cats that they have to take turns accessing paddocks. Officials say auctioning them will free up space and also reduce expenses. Zoo is currently housing 29 lions. The lions auctioned this week will be between 2 to 5 years of age. Each big cat is estimated to fetch around 150,000 Pakistan rupees. That's not too much, as some zookeepers claim. Even conservationists have expressed anger over auctioning lions to private collectors instead of transferring them to other zoos. Happy news for zoo-goers in Nicaragua. Two adorable baby tapirs are born at a country's national zoo south of Managua, adding attractions to the visitors. Two endangered tapirs, a male and a female, were born hours apart at the weekend. In the video shared by the zoo, one of the newborns is seen suckling and walking near her mother. The director of the zoo says the babies are yet to be named but are in perfect health. Tapirs inhabit jungle and forest regions of South and Central America, with one species inhabiting Southeast Asia. They look something like pigs with trunks, but they are actually related to horses and rhinos. Nicaragua launched a project that seeks to conserve this animal in danger of extinction due to hunting and the destruction of natural habitat.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Now we'll take you to mind-riddled French island, Chazoms, which is emerging from the ruins and gradually turning into walker's paradise. Chazombre, close to the port city of Saint-Malo, has an amazing landscape but remains uninhabited as it saw a devastating bombardment by the Allies during the World War II. The Nazi-occupied island was victim of the most bombings per square meter. Known as Martyred and Forbidden Island, it was opened only in 2018 after extensive demining efforts allowed the opening of a marked path. Now, every year, thousands of day trippers make the short boat journey, marveling at the spectacular maritime views and flourishing wildlife there. The safe area still makes up just 3% of the island, but it lets visitors wander between rusty cannons and bunkers. Some walkers say they hope the trail will be lengthened to allow a complete tour of the island.
Africa is taking back some of its greatest treasures stolen by the British back in the 19th century. The Horniman Museum in London has agreed to return the artifacts to Nigeria. These are 72 relics, which include 12 highly treasured brass plaques known as the Benin Bronzes. The bronzes are a group of several thousand metal plaques and sculptures that decorated the royal palace of the once mighty kingdom of Benin since the 16th century. These artifacts were looted from a region in modern-day Nigeria in a British military incursion. They later ended up in museums in Europe and the U.S. African countries have been fighting to recover works pillaged by explorers and colonizers as Western institutions grapple with the cultural legacy of colonialism. The Jamtal Glacier in Austria has been losing around 1 meter of its surface annually. Scientists say the ice is a precious archive that is simply melting away and are surveying the area. Austrian mountain researchers say the glaciers contain an invaluable trove of ancient frozen leaves and twigs and other scientific treasures that can be lost forever. They say the time capsules, including the remote Jamtal Valley, are falling victim to climate change. In the 1990s, tourists found that 5,300-year-old mummy of Iceman near the same area. According to the international data, global warming has raised temperatures in Europe's highest mountains by nearly 2 degrees Celsius in the past 120 years. French rescuers are racing against time to save a beluga whale stranded in Seine River near Paris. The beluga was first spotted stuck between two locks in the river from Paris to the English Channel on Tuesday. Specialists say the animal is undernourished and is refusing food. Warm water is also worsening the health of this creature, which is normally seen near Norway, some 3,000 kilometers to the north. Rescuers say they have only up to 48 hours to save the whale. They are now looking at the possibility of taking the beluga out of the water, treating it, and eventually transferring it out to the sea.
There are many big restaurants with Michelin stars awarded based on their quality. But you will be amazed to know that an eatery located in a tiny village in Greenland also has this badge of honor, making it the world's most remote Michelin-starred restaurant. This eatery in the village, which is home to only 53 people, serves you what it gets from its immediate surroundings. Looking out over the chilly North Atlantic, customers taste a variety of local products, ranging from whale skin to an Arctic bird whose entire wing, including feathers, is on the plate. The restaurant is so remote that you can only reach there by boat through floating icebergs. The head chef says he forages for wild berries, flowers, and herbs every day, since the menu largely includes local flavors.
Visitors and staff at a French zoo have celebrated the first birthday of twin pandas. The young bears were given a tasty treat of frozen cakes and other treats. As part of the event, five lucky visitors were also given the chance to participate in the celebrations behind the scenes with golden tickets. Other festivities included face painting and panda-themed activities. The baby pandas were born last August and now weigh 23 and 28 kilograms. They live with their mother at Zoo Parc de Bouval, where they have been on display since their arrival in 2021.
True the same is the light of guidance and the ship of salvation.
IRIB English Radio in the month of Muharram presents today's special. Every day for 15 minutes.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, salam. Allah's peace be upon all of you. Thank you very much for joining us. So welcome to this episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. In this episode, we're going to speak about the new concept of death in the school of Imam al-Hussein, peace be upon him. I invite you to join us. Today, Wednesday, is the 19th of Muharram, 1444 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 26th of Mordad, 1401 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 17th of August, 2022 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. We're going to listen to verse 157 of chapter Al-A'raf from the Holy Quran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. الذين يتبعون الرسول النبي الأمي العلمي الذي يجدونه مكتوبا عندهم الذي يجدونه مكتوبا عندهم في التوراة والإنجيل يأمرهم بالمعروف وينهاهم عن المنكر ويحل لهم الطيبات ويحرم عليهم الخبائث ويضع عنهم إصرهم والأغلال التي كانت عليهم فالذين آمنوا به وعزروه ونصروه واتبعوا النور الذي أنزل معه أولئك هم المفلحون.
Those who follow the messenger, the unlettered prophet, whom they find written in what they have of the Torah and the Gospel, who enjoins upon them what is right and forbids them what is wrong, and makes lawful for them the good things and prohibits for them the evil, and relieves them of their burdens and the shackles which were upon them. So they who have believed in him, honored him, supported him, and followed the light which was sent down with him, it is those who will be the successful.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, said, "He who enjoins right and prohibits wrong is the vicegerent of both Allah and his messenger on the earth." Imam Baqir alayhi salam said, "Verily, enjoining what is right and forbidding what is wrong is the way of prophets and the method of good doers. It is such a great obligatory deed, wajib, by which other obligatory deeds can survive, other creeds can be saved, bargains are lawful, injustices are warded off, and prosperity can be filled in the earth." Imam al-Husayn know he would be killed? Prophet Abraham got Allah's revelation in his dream. He narrated this dream to his son Ismail, who also was a prophet. The dream was that Ibrahim, peace be upon him, was slaughtering his son Ismail. Ismail said to his father that his dream was a revelation and that he should follow it and proceed with what he saw. Ibrahim did what he was advised by his son Ismail. Now Ismail went with his father even though he knew that he would be killed. Edward Gibbon, in his renowned work, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, states, "In the distant age and climate, the tragic scene of the death of Hussein will awaken the sympathy of the coldest heart. Imam Hussein, grandson of the last holy prophet, offered the greatest sacrifice to re-establish the truth firmly, never again to be shaken by anyone until the day of judgment."
Thank you.
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bi-nasta'in. In this episode, we are going to be concerned with the concept and phenomenon of death as reviewed by Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So we find that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam wasn't scared of death. He was never scared of martyrdom. Rather, in one of his addresses, he referred to martyrdom and death as a kind of bridge that leads people from the world of hardship to the world of delight and comfort. And at the same time, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam referred to death for the opponents of the Islamic religion as a bridge that would lead the enemies of Islam from a world of delight into the world of fire and punishment in the world hereafter. So we find that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam had two sorts of anticipations or two sorts of depictions of death and of the phenomenon of death. For the followers of the true Islamic religion and for his own companions, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam referred to death as a bridge that would lead pious people from the world of torture and the world of hardships into a castle of comfort and delight. And for the opponents of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, for the opponents of the Islamic religion, and for the infidels, for those people who fought the Islamic religion out of full knowledge on the day of Ashura, death was nothing but a bridge, a way, or a passage that led people from a place of pleasure and a place of comfort to the hellfire and chastisement.
On the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Husayn alayhi salam and his family and companions, be with today's special. Every day from IRIB English Radio.
People rise up and mourn, it is Ashura. See the struggle of Hussein in the Kabbalah.
A life like Ali and a death like Hussein. What a nice phrase. We must reflect on that monumental moment on the 10th day of Muharram, 61 AH, just before Ash prayer, when Imam Husayn stood on a sand dune at Karbala in Iraq. He looked at the murdered bodies of his loved ones. He looked skyward and prayed, O Allah, in you I place my trust aimed all grief. You are my hope aimed all violence. Then he raised the call, is there anyone who will come to assist us? Is there anyone who will respond to our call for help? He turned directions and repeated the call several times. Who was he calling out to? Surely he was not expecting anyone there to come to his aid, since those who he had relied upon had already betrayed him. Perhaps it was a call to people of conscience of every period, every generation in every land. It was a call for help against corruption, which everywhere in every age rears its ugly head to oppose, to oppress justice and undermine the truth.
Assalamu alaykum, ya Abu Abdullah. Wa ala al-arwah allati halat bifana'ik. عليك مني سلام الله أبدا ما بقيت وبقي الليل والنهار فلا جعله الله آخر العهد من زيارتك السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين على أولاد الحسين على أصحاب الحسين الذين بذلوا مهجهم دون الحسين عليه السلام.
Dear brothers and sisters, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to today's special from IRIB English Radio. Approach of Imam al-Hussein towards death. This is the topic of this episode. One of the great achievements of Imam al-Hussein is that he was able to remove the fear of death from the hearts, from his camp. They absorbed Imam's teachings when he purified them and won them over. In one of Imam al-Hussein's sermons addressing his people, he says, O son of the nobles, death is only a bridge which makes you from misery and loss to the eternal grace of paradise. Then is there anyone among you who dislikes to be transferred from a prison to a palace? For your enemies, death is the opposite. As my father quoted from Nabi Muhammad, peace be upon him, surely this world is a prison for the believers and a paradise for disbelievers. Death is a bridge to take some to paradise and some to hell. I have never told lies and was never told lies.
Sayyid Abbas Razavian.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. Peace and salutations upon you, O Master of Martyrs, Ya Sayyid al-Shuhada. We talked about benefiting from Ziyarat al-Shura. There's a very famous khutbah. It's called the khutbah of Ma'rifat Binuraniyat, meaning that you have cognition and understanding and knowledge through Nur. It means that there's another faculty of gaining knowledge besides the mind and intellect, that you can gain knowledge through the spirit. You can gain knowledge through nur and through light. Once Abu Dhar comes in this tradition, comes to Salman of Farsi, and asks him, what is this ma'rifat binuraniyat? What is this understanding and knowledge through nur? So Salman and Abu Dhar, they approach Imam Ali alayhi salam and they ask him. Imam Ali teaches them and says, Ya Salman wa ya Jundab, which is the name of Abu Dhar, Qala labbaik, we are ready, Ya Amir al-Mu'mineen, we are here. Innahu la yastakmilu ahadun al-Iman hatta ya'rifani kun hama'rifati binuraniya. Basically, this is a good question you ask. Nobody will reach the reality of faith unless he attains and recognizes me through nur. You have to know me through nur. You have to attain knowledge of me through your spirit. فَإِذَا عَرَفَنِي بِهَذِهِ الْمَعْرَفَةِ فَقَدْ إِمْتَحَنَ اللَّهُ قَلْبَهُ لِلْإِيمَانِ. If God gives somebody and tests him with true faith, gives them this nur, he will be given true faith, his light, his chest will be expounded. Then he tells him this, وَمَنْ قَصَّرَ عَنْ مَعْرِفَةِ ذَلِكَ فَهُوَ شَكٌ مُرْتَبٌ. And whoever does not understand me through light, he will be in doubt. So brothers and sisters, we are being taught from Imam Adi in this hadith that there's another faculty of realizing and connecting to the Holy Prophet, to the Ahlul Bayt, through nur and through light. That is what happens when you go to their ziyarat. You're connecting to Imam Mahdi. Then in the tradition it says, Ya Salman, Ya Jundab. And again they say, Labbaik, we are here, we're listening, we're ready for you, Ya Amir al-Mu'mini, O Commander of the Faithful. Ma'rifati binuraniya ma'rifatullah. Whoever has known me through light has known God. The more you know the Ahlul Bayt, this cognition that you have, you will know Allah. وَمَعْرِفَةُ اللَّهِ مَعْرِفَتَنِي بِنُورَانِيَةٍ. And the more you know Allah, the more you witness Him with your spirituality, the more you witness me. وَهُوَ الدِّينُ الْخَالِصِ. Do you want dinul khalis? Do you want pure religion? It is understanding and connecting and having cognition of the Ahlul Bayt through the spirit. That is Deen Khalis. That is pure religion.
So we follow this interesting topic. I mean, the death in Imam Hussein's view. So I invite you to listen to the next episode of today's special. Until then, fi amanillah.
ومماتي ممات محمد وآل محمد.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up,